Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Claude Lévi-Strauss, a towering figure in modern anthropology, has died at 100 in his native France. He was a giant 20th century thinker, reshaping ideas about humanity and culture. Lévi-Strauss promoted the idea that so-called civilized and primitive cultures were not truly different, that basic structures of myth and thought guide us all. His work has been called a practical anti-racist manifesto. It drew deep critics and raised deep questions about how we understand one another across cultures. It changed anthropology. This hour, On Point, the intellectual life and legacy of Claude Lévi-Strauss. You can join the conversation. Do you really believe we're all one or not? And what's the implication of your answer, of his answer? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now, and on short notice with this death, and we're very grateful for it. First in the studio is Noor Yalman, Professor Emeritus of Social Anthropology at Harvard University, a longtime scholar and admirer of Claude Lévi-Strauss, hails from Turkey and has also taught Middle East studies. He's thought a lot about cultural diversity and international conflict. His books include Under the Bow Tree and A Passage to Peace. Noor, thanks very much for being here today, Professor Yalman.
Great pleasure to be here.
And from Berkeley, California, is Rosemary Joyce, professor and chair of the Anthropology Department at the University of California, Berkeley. Her focus has been field archaeology in the Americas, trying to understand ancient civilizations in places like Honduras. Her books include Ancient Bodies, Ancient Lives, Mesoamerican Archaeology, and Gender and Power in Pre-Hispanic Mesoamerica. Rosemary, thank you very much for joining us, Professor Joyce.
Thank you for having me.
Some of our listeners will know the work of Lévi-Strauss very well, and others will be introduced now at the very end of his life. We'll be grateful for an education today. Noor Yalman, I wish you'd begin to take us into the significance of this thinker, this man in your field.
What a remarkable man, Lévi-Strauss. What an extraordinary thinker. What a creative person. In my opinion, his stature in anthropology is similar to Margaret Mead. Margaret Mead, after all, with her pioneering studies of growing up in Samoa, affected American culture profoundly and brought about really quite important cultural changes in America. Similarly, I would say that Claude Lévi-Strauss is, with his powerful ideas, affected anthropology, first of all, but also intellectual life in a very profound manner. To my mind, the most important contribution of Lévi-Strauss has to do with the idea that there really are no primitives. That this idea, which was so much associated with 19th century ideas of progress, whereby there are people in the vanguard of progress, and there are others who have left behind, and we can call them primitive. This idea was completely exploded by Lévi-Strauss, because he showed very specifically the degree to which people who used to be called primitives in fact had very sophisticated, complicated ideas which anthropologists would be able to understand. And the reason this is so important is because it really does away with the whole notion of racial inferiority, cultural inferiority. It raises major questions as to what progress is all about, in what direction we are progressing. So in that sense, his contribution was really very considerable.
Rosemary Joyce, you've done a lot of work in archaeology, in the very cultures that certainly had been labeled primitive. Now there stands the work of Lévi-Strauss. How's it affected the way people in your field, your line of work, view the world?
Well, I think I would second what Noor is saying about Lévi-Strauss restructuring the division between the modern and the pre-modern, And I, as an undergraduate, was very much affected, as I think everyone in my generation was, by his writing about the older idea that there were what he called cold and hot cultures, with modern Europe being seen as hot, really having history really changing, and traditional societies being seen as cold and unchanging. And one of the real remarkable things that he did was introduce a real concern with historical change, which is often missed by people who focus mainly on his groundbreaking work on structuralism, that he had an idea of there being substantial change in traditional societies, what had been called primitive societies. And in the sort of archaeological work that's been indebted to Levi-Strauss, and very recently a very strong body of work has been developed on some of Levi-Strauss's later life works, his most recent work, a large part of that has been looking at the way that within small-scale traditional societies, a large amount of historical contestation and symbolic communication was going on, so that, as Ner said, instead of thinking about these as traditional, unchanging, or primitive societies, we now understand that they're complex, complicated, and that reorientation in an important way introduced a notion of looking at history that is very congenial to archaeologists, since we look at the long-term history of change.
Structuralism. Rosemary Joyce raises the word. He had a complex relationship with it. He's been called the, you know, he didn't want to be called the father of structuralism. Yet the lines often leads right back to him. What is meant by structuralism? What did he mean when he talked in terms of structures behind human culture, society?
One of the most intriguing and accessible books on structuralism is a book by the famous Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget, called Structuralism. And what does Jean Piaget do in that work? He starts with mathematics and the structures of mathematics, and describes how mathematics is, of course, a logical structure which humans have invented and have applied to the natural world, and somehow, for reasons that are really very mysterious, our mathematics seems to work all the way up into the galaxies.
So we invented it, or we discovered it, or
we invented mathematics. We are still inventing it.
Yes, I suppose that's right. And yet, and it interferes with the reality as we find it, or creates the reality. I don't know.
Yes. And so Jean Piaget begins with mathematics, goes on to physics, from physics to biological structures, from biological structures to linguistic structures. And we know that languages are highly, highly structured, so that the slightest difference in sound are registered instantly by us and recognized. And then he moves on in the last chapters to the structures that are described by Levi-Strauss, that is to say, social structures and cultural structures.
What does that mean, social structures, cultural structures?
Social structures are easily defined. Those are organizations of society in which people have a place, and there are classes, and there are, in modern society, of course, there are professions and organizations of all kinds, and those are collectively referred to as structures.
And cultural structures?
Cultural structures is more obscure in that it is the idea of patterns in culture, which are different from one culture to another, and it takes a great deal of work and analysis to be able to tease them out as structures, and it is there that Levi-Strauss really made his greatest mark.
Rosemary Joyce, are you a structuralist, madam?
There was a time when I probably would have described myself as a structural or symbolic anthropologist. Certainly, when I was being trained in the 1970s and 1980s, that was a very important part of my practice, and especially in the kind of archaeological work that I do, that many archaeologists do, this kind of guide to thinking about cultural structures that Ner is talking about, was an extraordinarily important tool. In the Americas, where most societies didn't have writing, mm-hmm. and the writing that we do have from the Maya has only really begun to yield its knowledge in the last 20 years, to try to get at the fundamental conceptions people had about the world they lived in and how they related to other people, structuralism provided us a way to do that from their visual culture, from their art, from the way that they laid out their villages. And archaeologists have been among some of the most enthusiastic students of Levi Strauss, myself included, going all the way back to my very first sort of studies as an undergraduate. My very first honors thesis was based on using that sort of structural analysis that Levi Strauss introduced us to for broader cultural structures, using the metaphor of linguistic structure to explain to us how to think about these other forms of structures.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the intellectual life and legacy of Claude Lévi-Strauss, towering anthropologist, 20th century thinker, dead at 100. The thinker who challenged and redefined in many ways how we think of human culture. Noor Yalman is with us, professor of social anthropology emeritus at Harvard University. And with us from Berkeley, California, Rosemary Joyce, chair of the anthropology department at Berkeley, author of Ancient Bodies, Ancient Lives, and many more. She has who's gone very deep in the Americas, in prehistoric Americas. I've got a little bit of tape of Claude Lévi-Strauss. This is from 1972. He's talking in his native French here about his work, The Savage Mind. He talks about his work to interpret modes of thought of what were called primitive peoples.
Ce que je voulais montrer, c'est que, d'abord, la pensée que j'appelle sauvage,
saying here, what I wanted to demonstrate was, first of all, what I call savage. I mean to say, intellectual thought is something like a wild flower that develops in certain conditions of life away from civilization or that which we deem to be. Claude Lévi-Strauss in 1972. Noor Yalman, there I'm confused immediately because he's seems to be asserting that maybe there is such a thing as the savage or the primitive mind, and I thought this whole point was, no, they are us, we are them, we're one.
Good for you. That's a very good point that you're making. What he was really intending to say there is that all thought has this impromptu element of areas of thought that are not highly organized, which are like the sort of weeds in a well-tended garden. Savage mind, according to his ideas, is the kind of mind that is, as it were, in a conversation with itself, whereby it is throwing up new ideas in wild profusion. And in that profusion of wild ideas, there is order. This is what Lévi-Strauss has claimed and shown. And structure and order. Let's go back for a minute to mm-hmm. mathematics again. Mm-hmm. Mathematicians are constantly creating new forms of mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
This is taking place. Mm-hmm. And much of it has no practical application. It is the use of their imagination which produces the mathematics. What Lévi-Strauss was claiming is that even in the most primitive states of economy, in the most primitive, quote-unquote, ways of life that people were leading, say, Australian Aborigines mm-hmm. in the outback in Australia, they were still using their imagination in the most elaborate manner, rather like modern mathematicians. And they were creating these wonderfully rich worlds of myth and art and ritual and pattern, which of course these days are worth a great deal of money mm-hmm. for Australians. As you know, mm-hmm. the Aboriginal art is now greatly valued, but for a long time it was considered to be just crap, mm-hmm. nothing at all. Mm-hmm. So it is that sort of idea that that it is in the imagination of peoples that we can see new things, new developments, new creativity, and that this imagination is orderly and patterned. Let me give you a quotation from Lévi-Strauss in this wonderful little book called Race and History, which he did, I think, for UNESCO a long time ago, mm-hmm. certainly long before he became very famous. Mm-hmm. He says, in all matters touching on the organization of the family and the achievement of harmonious relations between the family group and the social group, the Australian Aborigines, though backward in the economic sphere, are so far ahead of the rest of mankind that to understand the careful and deliberate systems of rules they have elaborated, we have to use all the refinements of modern mathematics. It was they, in fact, who discovered that the ties of marriage represent the very warp and woof of society, while other social institutions are simply embroideries on that background. For even in modern societies where the importance of the family tends to be limited, family ties still count for much. Their ramifications are less extensive, but at the point where one tie ceases to hold, others, invoking other families, immediately come to play. What he's trying to say there is that these elaborate systems of kinship and marriage that anthropologists have described for the Australian Aborigines, and when I say elaborate, I really mean elaborate. Mm-hmm. They had rules whereby you could only marry your mother's brother's daughter's
That's
daughter.
Elaborate. Oh, good heavens. Okay. That's a small target.
Your own mother's brother's.
Yes, yes.
Mother's brother's daughter's daughter.
Forget it.
And the whole society was organized on that basis. And that's why Lévi-Strauss says you need mathematics to figure out what's going on. So these are, you know, people running around wearing, I don't know whether this word is appropriate on air, penis sheaths.
Yes, yes, right. And yet living within a very complex scheme of
living a very complex,
interaction.
Very complex scheme of family structures, mm-hmm. and also with the most extraordinary imagination as far as mythology is concerned.
We'll look at mythology, but Rosemary Joyce, on this fundamental dynamic, I mean, our senses of him as knocking down a kind of Western or imperial condescension toward these cultures, but was the message that there was or is no primitive state, or that there was, but it shares a basis with the, you know, quote-unquote civilized world?
Well, I think looking at what he said in Savage Mind is fundamental, mm-hmm. because as Ner pointed out, he's talking about a mode of thought, and he says that that mode of thought belongs to people in modern states as much as in the Australian Aboriginal. So modern mathematics is as much a product of this savage thought. And in fact, in illustrating it in The Savage Mind, he uses a comparison to a French concept of what we might call a tinkerer, a handyman who comes to fix something at your house mm-hmm. and has to improvise the mechanisms, the materials. Mm-hmm. So in essence, what he's doing is refusing to separate an us versus a them. He's interested in a fundamental form of human thought which continues in all societies today, so that we don't privilege some societies as being beyond this, what is in fact a very productive kind of thought. And repeatedly in his work, he doesn't respect a boundary between what we might think of as traditional anthropology, subjects of primitive people, and other kinds of societies. In his work on what have been come to be called in English house societies, for example, mm-hmm. he compares French medieval society to Northwest Coast American Indian society. Hmm. And that's a kind of bringing into the sphere of anthropology the European, that was not done traditionally.
It was sort of looked out or looked down on other native people, them, instead of all one, no boundary.
But it's basically saying that there are these modes of human thought, and they are understanding how they work among Australian Aboriginal people or other people in the Americas is as much about understanding how Europeans and the French, the British, the U.S. population thinks as about understanding. And that, I think, is one of the powerful legacies for anthropology is being able to say that what we're talking about in anthropology isn't just how to understand other people. It's how to understand ourselves.
I want to begin to turn to our listeners, if I may. Rosemary Joyce is with us from UC Berkeley. Nur Yalman is here from Harvard. Right now from Bowling Green, Kentucky, Jan is calling. Hi, Jan. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I feel like that there's been quite a bit of ignoring the contributions of Native Americans. I think that we've suffered a lot of discrimination, and there's been a lot of dissing our contribution to the understanding of the balance of nature mm-hmm. and the environment and our feeling about sense of community. The Cherokee were far more conciliatory as far as dealing with people from other places. But here in this community, people have told me, you need to go back where you came from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, where is that?
You're there. You're there if you're Native American. You are there. Janet, it's a great point, and right in the line of the work of Levi-Strauss. I mean, Nur Yalman, here's Jan, Native American herself, I see her, or in part, and you know, the message still isn't fully out there to her mind. It's a disrespected culture, a devalued culture. Claude Levi-Strauss did not romanticize Native cultures, including Native Americans, but certainly he spoke to the issue she raises here.
He spoke very directly, precisely to that issue, to indicate that, in fact, we must recognize the immense contribution of other cultures, the contribution that they have made to world civilization. And in that sense, in that spirit, he spent most of his life depicting the extraordinary riches of the mythology of South American Indians and also later of North American Indians. So he was very much in the direction that Jan is talking about.
And researching them not just as exotic, but as vital?
Vital, yes, certainly vital. But he was, of course, he would have considered himself to be a social scientist, and in that sense he was interested in patterns and analysis and so on. But he was also a very liberal person, so that he comes to the question of culture and the recognition of the different peoples of the world by saying that they need to be respected. All of them have to be respected. But then he puts it in very specific terms. May I read a little passage?
Certainly.
To indicate his thought on that subject? He says, we need to preserve the diversity of cultures in a world which is threatened by monotony and uniformity. And this has surely not escaped our international institutions. We must hearken for the stirrings of new life, foster latent potentialities, encourage every natural inclination for collaboration which the future history of the world may hold. We must also be prepared to view without surprise, repugnance, or revolt whatever may strike us as strange in the new forms of social expression. And here he really comes to it. Tolerance is not a contemplative attitude dispensing indulgence to what has been or what is still in being. It is a dynamic attitude consisting in the anticipation, understanding, and promotion of what is struggling into being. Oh. We can see the diversity of human cultures behind us, around us, and before us. The only demand that we can justly make, entailing corresponding duties for every individual, is that all the forms of this diversity may take, maybe so many contributions to the fullness of all the others. In other words, their contribution must be matched by the contributions of the others, so that the generosity of one side must be rewarded with the generosity coming from the other side.
And tolerance is not indulgence. Yes. Once again, sort of giving a condescension, a real kick in the pants.
Yes.
Lansing, Michigan, Rick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've read four books on World War II in the last 6 days.
Mm-hmm.
What I've found from having read those, that people easily find ways to differentiate between
and dehumanize the others, maybe.
Dehumanize the other, mm-hmm. like obviously in death camps and mm-hmm. With atomic bombs, prisoner of war camps, and firebombing of mm-hmm. cities.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so we're, you know, there's been, it goes both ways. It's something that we seem to be able to do without too much problem.
it's a good, important point, an enormous fact. Rosemary Joyce, Levi-Strauss lived through World War II. This is a man who grew up in France near Versailles, grandfather a rabbi, father a portrait painter. I think he spent much of World War II time out of Europe, but clearly he witnessed the active counter example to what he was teaching, certainly in that time and many others, Rosemary.
Well, I think it is an important point that because he was affected by World War II, it's in fact one of the reasons that he turned to the Americas and began to seriously work on the native societies of South America in particular, and in his book Tristro Peak, which I think is a powerful exploration of the difficulty of understanding other societies. He talks about being in the Amazon and trying to make contact with a society and understand it. So he was not naive about how difficult this is, nor in any way denying the fact that one part of the human social structure that we see over and over throughout history and that we find in all societies is a propensity or ability to draw a line between us and an other and then in some way oppress the other. So I think he actually spoke quite eloquently about many, many different instances in which societies that were traditional subjects of anthropology did this kind of ruling out of another group. And he talked in great detail about how cultural structures could be used or could actually serve for a group of people to understand themselves as different from another. So in that sense, like most anthropologists, he's confronting the entire spectrum of human abilities, which regrettably does include this ability to dehumanize and to then oppress others. But what, again, he's very strong about both is the fact that this is not somehow something that happened in primitive societies and that there's some notion of progress. He doesn't give in to this idea of progress, which anyone witnessing the violence of the 20th century would have had to be aware of.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the intellectual life and legacy of Claude Lévi-Strauss, towering anthropologist, dead at 100. He challenged and redefined how we think of human culture. With me this hour, Noor Yalman, professor of emeritus of social anthropology at Harvard University. Rosemary Joyce joins us from Berkeley, California, chair of the anthropology department at Berkeley. You're welcome to join us. Lots of callers here. Also, comments online. Here's one from Russell, who says, on the concept of the imaginative indulgence producing results of great value, it's been noted that mathematics was produced by quote-unquote civilized peoples, but the Aboriginal have contributed much more, he says, than mythology. Consider the hijacked knowledge of the world's botanical pharmacopoeia, which produced the practical result of creating one of the richest industries in the world. A tip of the hat right there. And a call right here from Charleston, South Carolina, and Edwin. Edwin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to take advantage of this very important opportunity, I guess, when anthropology is on everyone's minds and the mm-hmm. roots thereof, to mention Franz Boas, mm-hmm. who was doing the similar kind of work in trying to bring recognition to primitive cultures 50 years, really, before Levi-Strauss, and who was much reviled and went through, really, a very difficult path before he began to get any respect at all. This was at a time, of course, when a lot of theories were floating around about multiple creations.
Mm-hmm.
And, the Inuit people were the product of a rough draft of Adam and Eve and so forth.
Back in real sort of 19th century full-on racism interpretations.
Exactly. And in fact, I can't really go to New York anymore without going to the Museum of Natural History and going into that wing with the Northwest Indian, which really Boas was responsible for creating and took a lot of grief for doing so.
Edwin, thank you very much for that. Let me, Rosemary Joyce, if I may put to you the sort of the early path here from Franz Boas down to Claude Levi-Strauss. Do you see the footprints preceding him there?
Absolutely. And actually, this warms my heart because it goes back to when I was an undergraduate studying Levi-Strauss's work in a seminar at Cornell University, and my own final paper was about Levi-Strauss's self-conscious engagement with Franz Boas's work, which is sometimes overlooked. He was a scholar of massive knowledge of Native American ethnology, including all of the work of Franz Boas. One of the things I think that Boas did that the caller is alluding to is to introduce the idea that we needed to understand each culture in its own context rather than rank them in some kind of evolutionary scale.
Mm-hmm.
And this certainly resonates with Levi-Strauss's urging that we really understand each of these societies, each different societies, and not use them as some kind of proxies for stages. There are more direct kinds of connections that you can make or comparisons you can make with the way that Franz Boas looked at Northwest Coast art, which was a long-standing subject for Levi-Strauss's work as well,
mm-hmm.
and where both analysts did very similar kinds of work and really have been profoundly important in the understanding of Northwest Coast art. Edwin's referring to in Franz Boas's case, though, is there the sort of mistreatment he received during World War I, because prior to that he had been, in fact, very important in anthropology.
Mm-hmm. A kind of funny aside here with Levi-Strauss, for an anthropologist, he really didn't like the outback very much. He opened famously his Tristram Peak with the line, "I hate traveling and explorers, yet here I am proposing to tell the story of my expeditions." This out of his time in Brazil. But he wasn't much for the mud and the boonies, even though that's where a lot of his subjects were.
Yes, I mean, one of the things about Levi-Strauss's work is that it is not the kind of classic ethnography that most people think of if they know anything about, say, Margaret Mead mm-hmm. going to Samoa personally to collect the information. A lot of his work is based on material that other earlier ethnographers had collected that he looked at analytically, and his scope was massive. He made substantial contributions to understanding North American Indian, South American Indian, Indonesian, as I mentioned, French, as Nur mentioned, Australia. This is someone with a global scope, a vision of the comparison of the understanding of the entire world's cultures, and that is a different mode of anthropological analysis than what might happen from the work of someone who spent their time returning repeatedly to a specific field site.
Let me go to Vin in New Haven, Connecticut. Vin, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. I was hoping one of your guests could talk about the relationship that Dr. Strauss had with David Mayberry Lewis of Harvard.
Nur Yalman, please tell us.
Indeed so.
David Mayberry Lewis.
What a nice thought to remember David Mayberry Lewis in this context. David was my colleague at Harvard for many, many years. He died last year or the year before, just recently. He was very much a student of the Amazon and of the tribes in the Amazon, and very much involved with the work of Levi-Strauss, particularly to work out this notion of the relationship between their ways of life and their patterns of thought, and the relationship of social structures to their mental structures, and this great adventure that that Levi-Strauss has opened up in front of analysts of society. Maybe Lewis spent much of his life working on these Amazonian tribes, and in that sense, he was often in contact with Levi-Strauss, often at loggerheads with him, disagreeing and so on. But I must say that Levi-Strauss would very frequently in these intellectual debates get the upper hand as well, because he was extremely agile mentally. So was, of course, David Mabel Lewis. But there was an element of empiricism going back to social structures, the way people lived and so on, in the work of David Mabel Lewis, whereas Levi-Strauss would always emphasize the intellectual side to a greater extent. So in that sense, there was a sort of very productive dialectical debate between the two of them.
I want to come more to the post-structuralists and Levi-Strauss's critics, but let's see what else we have. Middletown, Connecticut. Jorge, you're on the air, Jorge.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My question really refers a little bit to a previous comments that were made, and I would like to direct it to the panelists. And it has to do with the question of, given that Levi-Strauss was politically liberal, as I think it was mentioned earlier,
yes,
with a deep understanding of global cultures, I'm very curious what the panelists might, if they have an opinion with their understanding of Levi-Strauss's legacy, how it intersects with contemporary culture and politics. And I know it's a little revisionist, but I'm wondering if there are any thoughts on how Levi-Strauss may have positioned himself, at least politically, with the question of like the Palestinian-Israeli situation today.
And what do you mean exactly there, Jorge?
What I mean, as best as I can articulate it, is that I'm trying to understand how Levi-Strauss's politics as a left liberal
and a Jew,
Jewish intellectual, might impact his understanding or his our understanding of the contemporary political situation among one of the the oldest conflicts in humanity. In the Middle East.
Well, let us pick it up. Nuri Alman, I'll come first to you. I mean, here we have a man teaching that, at some level we're all the same. There you have a conflict which seems insoluble, and a lot of invective has been hurled.
Yes.
Did you hear him speak to this particular issue?
Or no.
How he might apply his thinking?
He was not... He was not very concerned with immediate political affairs, and he had many, many supporters among Arabs, Arab intellectuals, particularly Moroccan and Algerian intellectuals in France. I don't think he took a stance on the issue in the Middle East, except, of course, that his work exemplifies the immense power of these mythologies, ideas of history, and how they can come to clash with each other. That's a very evident case in the case of Palestine-Israel, where there are two contradictory ideas as to what went on and what is going on, and also immense mythologies and the power of Christianity, Islam, Judaism, as a whole, showing the degree to which they have a hold on us still. But to go back to the issue of politics, I think it would be unfair to leave this discussion without mentioning his Levi-Strauss's very important influence on the continent on the breakup of old forms of socialist communist thinking.
Very critical of the Marxism.
Very critical in a very subtle way, because he would consider, he sometimes called himself a dialectical Marxist or a mystical Marxist even.
At the heart of his critique?
The critique was really directed in a very specific way, particularly in the last chapters of The Savage Mind, to Jean-Paul Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre, as you know, was the great supporter of traditional communist ideas in Western Europe, and he held on to these ideas in the teeth of the most dreadful events that were taking place in Poland and Hungary and so on. And he was, of course, much criticized. But in that debate, Levi-Strauss destroyed the intellectual foundations of Jean-Paul Sartre's idea of history. And I recall reading in the New Left Review by Anderson claiming that, in fact, it was that destruction of the intellectual edifice of communist and socialist thought in Western Europe that laid the foundation of the skepticism towards communism and socialism in Eastern Europe and in Russia. Yeah. And that in that sense, Levi-Strauss may well have had a very profound effect on the great revolution that led us to the breakup of the Berlin Wall.
20 years ago this month. Rosemary Joyce, our time begins to grow short. You said earlier, if I heard you right, that you had maybe been a structuralist earlier in your career, perhaps not now. And I wish you'd introduce us in just a couple of minutes we have to the important line of thinking that pushed back against Levi-Strauss, the post-structuralists of Foucault and Barthes and Derrida, and the main line of their critique, perhaps of yours, I don't know.
Well, I think one of the things to remember about post-structuralism is you can either treat it as an opposition to structuralism, but I think that's an inaccurate way to think about the evolution of thought. Yeah, a better way is to think of it as, in fact, a follow-up to structuralism. And again, here we have to credit Levi-Strauss's own objection to being called the father of structuralism. But the good things that we learned from structuralism were how to think about these systematic ways that culture and society might, in fact, be organized, and that these are universal in some sense. A number of post-structural reactions, and in fact, I would say that it's accurate to say my work has been post-structural, are basically reaching a point in structural analysis where you realize that there is a new problem that is framed. But that problem couldn't have been framed if it weren't for structuralism already being there as your tool. So sometimes structuralism is accused of being ahistorical. Now, I personally think you can find abundant evidence in Levi-Strauss's work that he understood that history had a directionality for traditional peoples as well as for modern peoples. But there is a way to do structural analysis as if it's universal, unchanging, which was not his way to do it. And much post-structural thought begins with worrying about questions of history, directionality, the fact that once something has been ordered in one way, that then becomes the basis for reordering, all of which I see as actually a development out of structuralism. And here I would point to an influential article by the anthropologist Sherry Ortner summing up anthropological theory through the beginning of the 1980s and basically saying that there were two main currents of thought: political economy, much of it Marxist, and structuralism, and pointing forward to the future and saying that both of those currents of thought would continue to be present in anthropology, although in transformed shape. And I believe that today what we're seeing is the transformation of Levi-Strauss's legacy has been the continuing work by other people doing work in what would be called practice theory, different forms of semiotic anthropology, a wide array of things that are essentially going back to the questions Levi-Strauss set for us.
And a final question, forgive me, but I have to ask. In Therese Tropique, he wrote that his view of mankind was ultimately of a race destined for extinction. He said the world began without the human race and will certainly end without it. We have only a minute, Nuri Elman. Why?
Well, it is obvious that if we continue producing these extraordinary powerful bombs, that one of these days some foolish leader is going to press the red button. In the future, one hopes that it never happens, but it is very possible that it might happen, and that might do us in. Otherwise, there is also, in the context of universal cosmic history, the life of our planet is, of course, finite. So that's another problem. In a way. But the real legacy of Levi-Strauss is that he questions the unquestioned acceptance of the idea of progress. What does progress mean? How do we progress, and in what direction are we progressing? Are we progressing in the direction of greater
or not? With that, we mark his passing today.
Ethics and morality.
Nuri Elman, Rosemary Joyce, thanks to both of you for being with us. Listeners, thanks for joining us. This is On Point.